Thank you for listening to this gospel resource from Cornerstone Baptist Church in Wylie, Texas. Feel free to use or share this resource, but we ask that you not alter the content in any way. For more information about Cornerstone Baptist Church, please visit us at cornerstonewylie.org.
Okay, so this is week 15 of Bible in a Year. You should have read Judges 19 through 21. The whole thing of Ruth, and then 1 Samuel 1 to 17. Summary of that. What is the summary? I think we wrap up Judges, and there's the whole incident with cutting up the girl into 12 pieces, and the outrage, and the slaughter of Benjamin, practically down to nothing. Was the idol incident, you know, the guy with the idol, and it was this priest Micah. Anyway, I don't remember. It was more than a week ago. Who knows? And then we have the whole thing of Ruth. We all know what Ruth is about. And then you have 1 Samuel, where we transition from, you know, the end of Judges. The writer states a common refrain again in the end of Judges was there was no king in Israel. And there were a few who tried to be king, like Gideon. And maybe certainly Abimelech, his son, but none of them really succeeded. And those who did try to become king ignored the requirements for the king, which is found in Deuteronomy 17. And so we might come back to Deuteronomy 17. It depends on where y'all want to go. And then we'll be like, hey, is Saul, you know, following Deuteronomy 17? But what we have is that there is it's clear that there's an absence of wise and faithful leaders like Moses and Joshua, and the people of Israel fall into chaos and intense moral corruption. And as a nation, you know, Israel made a covenant with the Lord to trust in the Lord with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, but in reality they never really did that. And they began to worship false gods, and they simply did what was right in their own eyes. And then from this point on, even with Ruth, so after Judges, but starting with Ruth, the books begin to focus on securing a king who will lead God's people with wisdom and righteousness. And Ruth is a backstory for the man that the Lord will eventually choose, which is David. And he's the last word in Ruth, I think. Is he the last word in Ruth? Yeah, he is the last word. So that's good. And so the setting for Ruth is actually in the days that the judges ruled. And so we have this great story with Ruth. And so what you should know from that is even in the mid of the deep darkness and chaos, the Lord is bringing out about light, which is the line of David. And then you move on to Samuel. And now you get Samuel's story, and then you get Saul's story, and then at the end there, we're introduced to David, and the last thing that we read was David and Goliath. Okay? So that's a summary. That was long. And, you know, that was 4 minutes. So anyway, now it's y'all's opportunity to talk about things you found interesting. And if not, you're going to get this stuff that I came up with, which is maybe not where y'all want to go. So we'll see. Anybody got anything?
The whole story of in Judges of the stranger and his concubine coming into town, and all of that's very striking, but it just I had to look, you know, I was listening through the reading, and I had to look to make sure I was in the right chapter, because it sure sounded like Sodom and Gomorrah, and, you know, it wasn't Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, right, yeah. There's a parallel.
It's crazy, like the wording is just so similar, and it turns out very differently. But anyway, just thought that was pretty crazy.
Yeah, they wanted to know the stranger in the guy's house, and then he threw out his concubine and had their way with her all night, and she died, basically, right? And so then he does this extreme thing where he cuts her up into 12 pieces and sends it to the 12 tribes, and then... Did it strike you? Did anything there strike you as like really odd? The reaction of one of the tribes,
Benjamin.
Yeah, like Benjamin. Like, why is Benjamin defending their people or this? You know, like they defend him to the death, and they kill tens of thousands, and then finally, you know, Benjamin. All of them die down to 600 of them, 600 men, and that's it. And they become like the smallest tribe, which is why Saul says later, "I'm from like the smallest tribe," because he really is. They were nearly wiped out. So that's a lot. That's some parallel there with Sodom and Gomorrah. Yes. Anything else? Y'all got to talk. Come on.
Yeah, I think for once all the other tribes reacted as God would want them to. That they purged the evil amongst their midst. I was like, alright, there sounds like there's a ray of hope for the Israelites still. They're taking sin seriously amongst their
midst. It was interesting that they went before God said, you know, which tribe shall go up, you know, shall lead us into battle against Benjamin. God said, I think it was Judah, but then there's no explanation for, I don't recall an explanation for why they went out twice and were defeated twice, and then the third time God gave them into their hands, but they did go to the Lord.
Yeah, I thought that was strange because they're asking who should go up, and he says, but they didn't ask the question, or he didn't provide the information that, oh yeah, you'll be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So, the lesson for me is ask if you'll be successful. Yeah, that was, and you know, a lot of them died. A lot of them. Okay. Wow. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Do we want to move on from Judges?
Please.
So you have the whole book of Ruth, and then you have lots of Samuel here. So does anybody have anything interesting there? If not, I got to talk. That might not be very good.
Wouldn't Ruth have just spoken plainly to Boaz about the whole thing, like this whole like clandestine meetings kind of sketch-ish?
Sketchy. The Ruth going to Boaz, yeah. And laying at his feet. See, that's what I wanted to talk about. And you're bringing it up. I only wanted to talk about Ruth and not anything else. So, yeah, we could go there unless somebody is really itching to talk about Samuel and Saul and David. Okay. Ruth. So the first thing we know with this is really interesting. I found this morning. So we have Ruth starts with Elimelech and Naomi and Mahlon and Chilion. Okay? And I'm like, great. And Elimelech means God is king. That's the Naomi's husband. So he dies. And then you have Mahlon, and his name means sick. Like, I'm naming my own kids, right? And so, you know, just think about, like, Max, for instance. Well, what does Max mean? He's great. So that means none of you people can call him a stupid idiot. You're going to call him great his whole life. And then here's this guy, Mahlon, and they decide to call him sick. Sick or wounded, right? I'm like, okay, well, I guess he was because he's dead. And then you have Kilion, and his name means, where is it? Wasting. Sick and wasting are their kids. Or you could say his name means failing or annihilation or coming to an end. So there's one guy who's sick and another guy is coming to an end and being wasted, and that's what they did. So like, I didn't believe it. Like, I was reading this one little commentary on it. I'm like, are you serious? Their names mean this? And it's like, there's just more irony in names. And so I had to look it up from several sources. I'm like, is this for real? And it is. Like, so their father means, you know, God is king, Elimelech. And the two sons are sick and wasting. And then Naomi means... I forgot what that meant. She wanted to be called Mara, which is bitter. So Naomi means pleasant. So we have parents, God is king and pleasant, having sick and wasting as kids. I mean, how does that make any sense?
Were they changed at some point? Like, huh? Were the names changed at some point as is common?
You wonder if it was changed.
Was it, have you seen this before?
Oh, you mean like, they age 10 years as kids and like, no, you're really...
Well, like similar to like Naomi changing it to Mara, right?
Yeah, I
like
know.
There's a backstory to that, or like Paul to Saul, or Saul to Paul, etc. Like, I don't know, I'm imagining something
you're
happening.
You're remembered as sick and wasting and annihilation.
He was born really sick.
yeah. I don't know. Like, I guess, you're saying maybe their names were changed because like... things happening in their life. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just think it's just there's some weird stuff always in the Bible. Now you get to Ruth herself, who's introduced. And what do y'all have to say about Ruth? Do you know anything about, like, it emphasizes she's a Moabitess. So what does that really mean? Do y'all know anything about that? See, I'd rather you tell me than I tell you.
Moabites being Lot's daughters.
Yeah, Lot's daughter. That was an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter. And, okay, so think about what I'm going to say here in light of Ruth. So Lot was drunk. The daughter comes in and probably lays at his feet and then makes additional moves. Okay, and so then you have the incest happening and the result is the Moabites. Okay, well, are you hearing any parallel in Ruth there? So there is, and so basically Naomi is telling Ruth to go in and lay down at his feet, and he's drunk. It said he's been drinking. So I don't know if he's drunk. It just said he's been drinking. So the implication there is that he's been drinking, and she lays down at his, she goes into him, lays down at his feet. Is Naomi telling her to seduce him? Because she didn't do explicitly what Naomi said. Naomi said, go in and lay down at his feet, and then he will tell you what to do. But Ruth opened her mouth and did something different than what Naomi told her to do. So we'll get to that, maybe. But again, let's go back to the Moabitess. So she's a Moabitess, and that's an accursed race. And she was born in paganism. And if you look at Deuteronomy 23:3, see, I just wrote down that reference. I didn't write down the verse. But this is an interesting thing. Deuteronomy 23:3. Yeah, there it is. No Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. And yet we have Ruth, a Moabitess, who does.
Maybe she was the 11th generation.
Maybe. I'm wondering how we reconcile this, because has it been 10 generations? this is also similar to Judah and Tamar. So what we have here is like Tamar needs to have a child. And if you remember, Judah's sons, the first son died. He was going to save Tamar for another son who needed to grow up. But then when he grew up, he didn't give Tamar to that son. So Tamar takes it upon herself and disguises as a cult prostitute. And Judah says, okay, fine, how much do you want? And it happens. And then later, you know, it's told to Judah that your daughter-in-law is clearly pregnant and now he wants to kill her, but she has the cord and something else and the ring, and says the man who this belongs to is the father. And Judah's like, oh, you're more righteous than I. So we have this thing where, you know, according to the law, the woman needs to have a kid by somebody in the family. Usually it's the brother. And Judah didn't fulfill this. And so Tamar took it upon herself to do the same thing. But you can go back to Lot even, and these daughters are like, there's no man left. How are we going to have a child? And so they take it upon themselves to make this happen. And we get to Ruth, and it's like, Naomi is advising her to take it upon herself to make this happen, right? I think it's all very similar, but yet no Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, which is really kind of strange. And what else do you know about Moabites? They're mentioned here in Judges and elsewhere, and even in Deuteronomy more. Numbers 25, remember Numbers?
Aren't they on the list to be wiped out?
Yeah, the Baal of Peor, those were Moabites. And they were women who seduced the men into, you know, and they're not supposed to marry foreign women, but the women seduced them. So it comes back as like Naomi advising Ruth to seduce Boaz. And it's not there in the text, but is it, what do you think? Is it implied at all? Nobody wants to answer that one. And then you have the Moabites too. They worshipped, their most feared of all God was Chemosh or Molech, I don't know if I'm saying that right. And this god had, the way they messed with Chemosh or worshipped him is he had his place on a platform of movable stones, so the idol did, and great fires would be kindled underneath Chemosh. And then his lap was so constructed that children placed upon this red-hot surface would roll down into his fiery belly as a sacrifice. And yet, remember this, Naomi's standing there in front of, what's her name? It's not Oprah. How do you say her name? It's not Oprah.
Huh?
Orpah. She's standing there in front of Orpah and Ruth saying, hey, go back. Go back to your own land. I'm like, really? Like, go back to the worship of Chemosh or Molech and, you know, witness all this child sacrifice? And there was another Moabite goddess, which was just another fertility goddess. And this goddess offered them regeneration through gratifying their lust with the harlot priestess in the temple. Okay, so yeah, it's like, hey, go back to this. Naomi's advising these daughter-in-laws of hers. I'm like, this is like really, like if she really believes in the one true God, why is she telling her daughter-in-laws to go back? Like, I'm just, what does it say about Naomi herself? Do you think she has any faith at all? No. I think it's like Naomi's is a prime character in the book of Ruth, and her faithlessness is a big contrast with the actual faith of Ruth herself. And these are just some things that, you know, I've been noticing, that I noticed. Okay. Anything, any comments?
Laying down at the feet, wasn't that some kind of tradition, though? Like, I know that it's loaded with a bunch of context about parallels to previous stories, but wasn't that act some kind of cultural thing at the time?
I have no idea.
I think Justin preached.
Did he?
Through Ruth and on this specific passage a while back. It was like a few years ago. But yeah. I don't remember anything that he said that led me to believe that that Ruth had ulterior motives or anything like that.
What was that Ruth had what?
Oh, I was saying, I think Justin preached through this passage a few years ago, and from what he said on this passage, I don't recall him saying anything about him thinking Ruth had ulterior motives in how she went about it. You know, maybe Naomi did, but...
Yeah, it's been a long time, but I think a sermon I heard at the church where I grew up in, I remember him saying that was like some kind of marriage proposal, right? Like, it sounds crazy to us, as it usually does, things happen in the Old Testament, but that was a way for the woman to basically ask the man to marry her. Sounds like a weird way to do it, but I don't know. I think that's what I remember hearing about it.
Kind of just the fact that Pete said, well, you know, hold off, I gotta ask this other guy. Kind of implies that to me.
Well, and even how he was like, you know, you didn't go after someone younger or more rich than me, like, that would make sense in that context.
Spreading the corner of his role over is, I guess, she's asking, can I come under your protection? Can I be under your refuge?
This whole concept of a redeemer also seems there's some context there. Yeah, all that we're seeing is, I think, like, it sounds like right now what you're proposing is a pretty negative view, and I'm still kind of working through that. I feel like the case still needs to be made.
Well, don't you know, that's always where I go, is the really negative view.
Yeah, so I guess that's the pushback. I don't know if it's...
No, you can push back, right, because the real story here is the things that... is the story between Ruth and Boaz, and that's the positive story. And the redemption story here. But what I'm trying to say is like, what I think for me, what she's being advised to do by Naomi is very negative. But Ruth turns it around, and instead of, like, again, every instance of a Moabite woman that you've seen in the Bible so far, they seduce the men. And Ruth is not doing that. So she just goes in there and lays at his feet, uncovers his feet, and she stops. And maybe it's implied, maybe it's not. But then he wakes up, and then she says, what does she say to him immediately when she wakes up? I am Ruth, your servant. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. So that really means marry me, you know. So it's like there is no seduction here. And Naomi did not tell her to do that. She comes up with that on her own. But she understands that he's the redeemer. And so then she's just like, she's basically proposing to him at that point, but then he has to deal with the fact that there's another who's closer and can redeem her. And that's, this guy doesn't want her. You know, and why, you know, think about that. Why would anyone really want Ruth? Because you're commanded not to marry a foreign woman, and that's what she is. Then she was married to Mahlon, right? She was married to him for 10 years, I think. And there are no children. So she's foreign, not a virgin, and barren. I mean, this is what she's proved herself to be. And so why would any man think that she's attractive? You know? And so despite all this, Boaz still redeems her. But the other guy, you can see, is like, oh yeah, I'll buy the property. And then he goes, oh, well, you also have to acquire Ruth. And he mentioned the Moabites. So Boaz, I think, knows what he's doing here. And then the close relative says, I cannot redeem it for myself. Like, he very quickly gets rid of this. It's like, no, I don't want her, you know. And so it's just very, it's an interesting exchange there. And then Boaz is like, you know, and honestly, if you read the Deuteronomy 25, which is taking care of the widow and how that's supposed to go, and you know, you're supposed, like, the brother should take her as a wife and then have an heir for the brother. If you read all that, like, they're kind of following this, and they're at the city gate, and it's at this point that, you know, Ruth should have got up with her sandal and whacked them with it, because that's what it said. And it's like, thus shall be done to, you know, the man who does this in Israel. So I'm like, where is that? Like, that would have been great for, like, Ruth to whack him really, really good. But I don't know. It doesn't happen. And so then, you know, there's some more things here. So let's see. Yeah, I said that. Okay. And then you have the connection here that as, you know, and it's interesting. Another interesting thing here in Ruth is at the very end of it, you get verse 16, chapter 4. Naomi takes the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And then all the women around gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. So they named him Obed. A son has been born to Naomi. And he is the father of Jesse, the father of David. But he's supposed to be named after Mahlon, right? But now you look at this, and it says these are the generations of Perez. Perez, Hezron, Ram, Amminadab, Nahshon, Salmon, Boaz, not Mahlon, Boaz, Obed, Jesse, David. So, you know, he's clearly not, you know, we're clearly not, like, raising up the son after Mahlon. This is Boaz's son. So it's sort of strange here. A son has been born to Naomi. Nope, not really. The son was born to Boaz, and that line, and it just turns it. So, some interesting things. Okay, that's all I have on Ruth, unless you want to, like, delve into the redemption a little bit more. But I was focusing on, like, really negative stuff this morning.
Any chance you know what Obed means?
Obed. I didn't look that up, but it says a son was born to Naomi, so they named him Obed. That must have something to do with that phrase. It usually does. Do y'all have any notes as to what Obed means?
Servant or worshiper.
Okay. What's that, like, Google? Oh, it's in the Bible.
ChatGPT, of course.
Oh, it's ChatGPT.
What's Google?
I guess I'm old. Just Google it. Now it's just ChatGPT it.
Or probably give an AI answer.
I was going to say, does anybody want to double check it?
I Googled it and I found the same thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You did.
Can you explain what it is that Ruth did that you're saying Naomi just tell her to do? Because it says in verse 5, all that you say I will do. And so it says that she did exactly as her mother-in-law had commanded her.
She spoke.
But she did what Naomi told her to do, was to lay there until Boaz. Boaz would tell her what to do. And so Boaz is the one that spoke first and asked her who she was. So Naomi didn't tell her not to speak. She just said to lay there until Boaz tells her what to do. So I'm not seeing where she did something that Naomi didn't tell her to do.
She didn't do what... So what I'm getting at is she didn't do what I think Naomi was implying for her to do.
Okay.
So, like, I'm stretching it a little bit, and you're not.
Well, I'm just...
And that might... Your way might be better.
Yeah. I don't know. I just see that Ruth did exactly what Naomi told her.
She did, but I think the statement, you know, well, she's responding, who are you? And right. she could have just stopped it, I'm Ruth, you know, and then, but then she goes on and says, spread your covering over your maid, for your close relative, so.
Yeah, which could or could not be part of whatever Naomi was hoping would happen.
Yeah.
It could be that she's, like you're saying, she could be veering off from the plan, or it could be part of it. There's really no way to know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I think I read like 3 or 4 people talking about this, and I just focused in on the really negative thing, where it was a commentary of a guy just talking about how bad Naomi was and how great Ruth is, and then there was others that were just seeing the whole thing in a positive light. So that's where I went. I went to the negative. Okay.
And I think it's interesting. It's important to have both perspectives.
Yeah.
Because I think oftentimes, at least Christians today, will look at this and say like, "Oh, women should go and put themselves in places where they can get married." Right? It's like maybe that's not all you can learn from.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Or you want to move on? We can go into Samuel if you want. Samuel starts, and you have Elkanah and Hannah, and again we have like the more loved wife is barren, kind of like Rachel and Leah. The more loved wife is barren, and the one who's not as much is having all the children. So we see that parallel. And then Hannah prays, and her prayer is answered, and Samuel is the result. And then you have this whole, where is this? Chapter 2, the first part of chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, we have Hannah praising God in response to the miraculous gift of a child. And it's kind of like a prelude to the Song of Mary, which happens in Luke 1, 46 to 45, which is also a praise to God in response to the miraculous gift of a child, which is Christ. So we have God looking upon Hannah and her humble estate and blessing her, just as God looks upon Mary and her humble estate and blesses her. And by blessing Mary, that has blessed us all, because all who call upon the name of Christ, Mary's son, the Lord Jesus, will be saved. That's Romans 10:13. So did you see that? Do you know, just read it.
Stretch to say that Mary was basing herself off of this tomb.
Oh, but it's a stretch to say Mary was basing.
I'm saying, I don't think it's a stretch.
Oh, yeah.
I think she knows her Old Testament.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Then you have Samuel called and hearing, whereas the old priest, what's the old priest's name? It's Eli, right?
Eli.
Eli's, not hearing, but Samuel is. And then, Samuel doesn't want to tell him what he heard, and Eli just demands it, like, no, tell me. And that's pretty sad. And then you have the battle, and his sons die, his awful sons, It's interesting there, too. Eli has awful sons who are sticking the fork in and taking whatever meat out they want, and they're also, like, messing around with the women who serve in the temple. and so they die. And Eli himself is very large and fat or something, and he breaks his neck when he falls backwards. But then, you know, also you go forward to Samuel, and it says he has two awful sons. Does that say anything to you?
Bad parenting.
Huh?
Bad parenting.
I don't know.
Like master, like disciple?
Like I was thinking, yeah. Samuel picked up his habits from him.
I just think the Bible is full of all these little warnings, you know, it's like, oh, well, here's a good guy, awful kids, you know, and another, here's a good guy, awful kids. And so, you know, I've always thought, you know, I really got to watch out, you know, because I'm going to have some awful kids. You really got to pay attention to this stuff. You know, and I mean, we have no details as to how Samuel was as a parent whatsoever. There's just nothing there. But somehow he has these awful kids. And maybe, and we know too, that maybe there's nothing that we can do. You can have great parenting, awful kid. And, you know, you can have terrible parenting, great kid. I mean, it just, how does that happen? We could do the same thing in the house with those kids, and you'll have five or six of them, and two of them are horrible, you know, and it's just like, what's going on? So, maybe it's just they're called and the others are not. I don't know. That's really scary, but it's kind of a warning. It's always a warning for me to like, you know, watch out for your kids and stuff. And man, I don't always do, but I think that I'm fairly involved with the things that they do and always have been on purpose, you know. So I'm commenting a lot. Do y'all have any comments?
I enjoyed reading about Elkanah's character. Because obviously he's like, you know, I'm better to you than 10 sons, am I not? And then he had the power to overturn or to void Hannah's vow, but he didn't. So he could have said, my firstborn son, my beloved wife, why would you send him to the temple? But he chose to be God himself. And yeah, I just enjoyed reading about him.
Yeah, I never thought about that. Because when a woman makes a vow, the man can overturn it. We read that. I don't know, where did we read that? It must have been Deuteronomy, right? Yeah, we just read that. I'm like, oh, okay, so the woman's vow means nothing. And I'm just thinking about it. And then we get to this, and Hannah makes the vow, and Elkanah lets it ride. It's like, okay, great. So that does speak to his character then. It's just like he's gonna let that stand. So that's great. And there's no men. Did Hannah have other kids?
Yes.
Yeah.
She did. Okay. Right. She did. Okay.
I always wondered what Hannah would have looked like that would have made Eli jump to the conclusion that she was drunk when she's at the temple praying. No, natural for somebody at the temple to do kind of thing.
You know, some people just can't recognize good people when they see them. even this morning, my wife was relating a story to us in the car, and Clara knows what I'm talking about, but I'm not mentioning names. But, you know, it's just that it's always that person's fault, right? And my wife was saying, no, it's not. It wasn't their fault. And I had to turn them around to get them to realize that. And like, so you just look at some kid that you, I don't know, they did something and you don't like them, and it's, they were in that crowd and it was their fault. No, it's not. I mean, it's not always their fault. Like, you need to be able to see the good in them, I guess, here. So maybe Eli's just one of those guys like me. He just sees the horribleness in people all the time. It's like, what is she? Oh, she's drunk. But he saw that because her mouth was moving. That's it. That's his only conclusion. So I don't know why he was thinking that. Okay. Not drunk. What else?
I think we see this sin of indulgence. Like Eli, God is judging him for not doing anything about his sons.
Yeah.
We see the same in David. Like it seems another pattern in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's one thing to have bad kids, but not doing anything about it, God doesn't appreciate that.
That happened with Jacob too, with the Shechemites, right? He didn't do anything about the rape, and then his sons do, and then later he just, you know, he scolds them for that very thing, like killing all the Shechemites, and like, you've made me a stench among the Canaanites here. And I'm like, why do you even care? But yeah, it's like these fathers don't do things. Oh boy, what another warning. Like, you know, do something, father, right? And then David didn't do anything. That was, we'll read that. Maybe we'll read that this week. I'm not sure. But okay, I'm not going to say anything about David not doing anything because we're going to read it soon. Okay, anything else?
I think one of the things like these men in the Bible, when you see their failings, I think a lot of the times, like with Eli, you're like, well, he's a priest. Well, Samuel, he's a priest too. But I don't know, I feel like, or I guess my gathering from all of this is like whenever David does something, they're so concerned with building the kingdom, with doing all their things that their office tells them to do, that they don't bring their children along with them. Versus like with Christ, when he said, let the little children come to me, they're like, well, don't bother Christ, but Christ is like, bring them to me. So that's what they should have been doing with their children, is bringing them.
Just involving them, yeah. Yeah.
But that's just, I guess, often a failure to see over and over with the men of the Bible is failing to bring their children along with them.
Kind of piggybacking off of that, I think you see over and over again in the Old Testament, especially in Proverbs, that bad kids are supposed to be a reflection on the parents. And so I don't think it's the, you know, it's not really an argument about the sovereignty of God as much as it is like when God commands his people to do something, there's usually an expectation or a promise that comes with that. And I think that the expectation of the Old Testament is that when you're a faithful father and mother, that God is going to bless that with your kids. Not that you're twisting his arm or anything, but I do think it was probably very far from kind of our modern crapshoot understanding of parenting, where it's like, oh, I could do all these things, but you know, I could have 8 kids and raise them all super well, but God will just, maybe God will decide that all of them will fall away. I don't think that was like the norm in the Old Testament.
No, I don't think that was either. Yeah, and you need to, I mean, that's Deuteronomy 6, you know, teach them all this stuff and wherever you're going, no matter what you're doing, and that's involving them in your life. I mean, and I discussed that really like more than 20 years ago with Shaney, is like, I need some kind of job where the kids can be with me. It just never panned out for me though. Like, but I was always thinking that, like, get something to do where I can involve them with it. But I've always worked for the man, and the man doesn't want the kids around, right? So you have to involve yourself in other ways. And I guess we try to do that. Anyway, we're late, so let's pray. And we'll get out of here, and we really didn't get to David. Hopefully we'll talk about that maybe next week. And there's a lot of contrast between Saul and David, but even this thing with David and Goliath, he completely and totally put his trust in the Lord, whereas Saul stood on the sidelines and let someone else fight for him. David is like, I'm going forward, trusting that God will fight for me. So maybe we'll talk about that next week. Who knows? All right, let's pray. God, our Father, I thank you for your word. Help us to always get into it, to love it, and to understand it. and to apply it to our lives, and help us to be like David, who does trust in you, and help us to love you with our all of our mind, all of our soul, and all of our strength. And we thank you for Christ. It's in his name we pray. Amen.